Welcome to Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio with author, speaker, and your host, Pat Rulo. Serving you a generous helping of everything you need to know to help you and your loved ones stay safe during any doctor or hospital visit. The program is not intended to replace medical advice from a licensed professional, but rather to encourage you to become a well-informed participant in your health and well-being. And now, your host, Pat Rulo.
Hello and welcome. I'm Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety, where each week we delve into little-known healthcare and hospital hazards, as well as other fringe topics that affect your health and well-being. I'm so happy you've taken the time to join me, and today I have lots to share with you. So, let's dig right in, shall we? On a frigid February afternoon in 2005, Dr. Peter Grinspoon, a Harvard-trained medical doctor with a thriving practice, walked into his office to find a Drug Enforcement Administration agent and a Massachusetts state police officer waiting for him. Thanks to a tip from a sharp-eyed pharmacist, the officers had evidence that Grinspoon had been writing Vicodin prescriptions for his own use in the name of a former nanny who had long since returned to New Zealand. They informed Grinspoon he would be charged with 3 felony counts of fraudulently obtaining a controlled substance. After years of writing bad prescriptions, sharing pills with patients, and raiding supply closets, Grinspoon had been caught and his addiction exposed. The following morning, Grinspoon drove to police headquarters, where he was booked and fingerprinted. How did a respected doctor who seemed to have it all, a successful practice, adoring patients, top academic credentials, 2 great children, and a lovely wife, end up here? You're listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo, the voice for patient safety. And you will find the audio of today's interview archived at the website speakupandstayalive.com. Our guest today, Dr. Peter Grinspoon, was a success, a Harvard-educated MD with a thriving practice, 2 great kids, and an accomplished wife, a pillar of his community. However, beneath that picture-perfect facade, he was an addict, secretly consuming dangerous amounts of prescription medications every day. And when 2 detectives showed up at his office, the facade crumbled. Having BS'd his way to success for years despite his addiction, he believed he could manage his way out of this mess by fiat. Instead, he wound up in rehab with an unlikely mix of medical professionals and OxyContin heroin addicts. His ego and the disease of his addiction kept him seesawing precariously between relapse and recovery, with his family and career in free fall until he finally truly hit bottom. His book, Free Refills, is the harrowing, moving, and darkly funny story of how he overcame his addiction to live honestly and cleanly, became a much more compassionate doctor, and even came to counsel other physicians struggling with this addiction. Dr. Peter Grinspoon currently practices as a primary care physician at an inner-city clinic in Boston and is on the staff at Massachusetts General Hospital. He teaches medicine at Harvard Medical School, and he spent 2 years as an associate director for the Physician Health Service, part of the Massachusetts Medical Society, working with physicians who suffer from substance abuse disorders. He attended medical school at Boston University of Medicine. His internship and residency were in internal medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Today, he is proudly 9 years clean. He lives in Newton, Massachusetts with his wife, Liz Grinspoon, and his blended family. And after reading the book, I am just delighted to welcome you to the show, Dr. Peter Grinspoon.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Now, I have to say that I've never tried drugs, so I don't have a clue as to what it means to be addicted to drugs, but I have to say that I was truly addicted to your book. So thank you for sending me a copy.
Well, hopefully you aren't withdrawing from it.
I think I am. I sat down one Sunday afternoon late in the day, and I seriously did not get up from my chair until I read all 230 pages. Your style, your honesty, and your sarcasm was so compelling and actually quite haunting that I do find myself 3 weeks later still thinking about it. So today's an exciting day for me to share you with our listeners. Well, let's get started. Give us a little background. What was your very first experience with drugs, and how did that propel you into further use?
Well, my first experience with drugs was using marijuana as an early teen, probably age 12 or 13. And while I don't personally believe that marijuana is a quote-unquote gateway drug, I think the same sort of personality traits that would impel me to sort of experiment and try marijuana at such an early age are probably the similar personality traits that would lead me during medical school to, like, be curious, kind of like the camel with his nose under the tent, lead me to start experimenting with opiates. The problem is opiates are so addictive. Once you start experimenting, you can get hooked really quickly.
Well, yeah, this kind of stems back from your childhood. Your dad is a well-known psychiatrist who researched marijuana in the 60s along with other drugs and really became quite a drug expert and advocated for medical marijuana. And you tell in your book about all of the great thinkers who would visit your parents' home for parties and dinner, and drugs were part of the scene. I understand there's a personality component to it. Do you think that because you had access and basically approval to drugs within your own home as a child, do you think that might have been part of a catalyst?
Certainly, we certainly didn't get a loud, strong message that drugs are bad. So in all honesty, my dad's sort of idea was that marijuana should be treated like alcohol and should be illegal for kids and legal for 21-year-olds, kind of like alcohol. So it wasn't like he was advocating it for kids. But we definitely saw people really enjoying themselves and having these super interesting conversations. And I think it just sort of de-stigmatized them for me. Mm-hmm. And they just seemed like something fun and interesting. They weren't like this taboo thing. And if you start off with marijuana, it just, who knows, but it just seems like I never developed that kind of healthy fear of other drugs that it seems like a lot of other people did.
Well, now give us some perspective. What drugs were you using? What are they supposed to treat when taken properly? What is the usual dose and how many were you taking? Just give us a bit of perspective as to where you were really at with all of this.
Well, at the height of my addiction, I was taking probably 15 to 20 Vicodin a day. The usual dose would be 1 to 2 every 6 hours. Vicodin's a powerful opiate narcotic, and it causes a lot of euphoria. It also causes a lot of, like, overdose deaths and damage, as everybody's reading about. We're in the middle of a national overdose epidemic. But the main drugs that I got addicted to were the prescription opiates. And as I'm sure we'll talk about later, there really is an incredible combination for physicians of access to medications and stress. And I feel like the combination of access and stress puts physicians at particular risk for addiction.
Yes, thank you. We really are going to dig into that in a bit. So now your honeymoon was really a turning point for you when you snuck off from your wife and called in a medication for yourself from a payphone just outside the pharmacy under the name of someone else. That was kind of your first aha moment when you realized that you could write your own prescriptions.
Well, it was an aha moment at the time because from the point of view of my kind of crazy addictive thinking, it was a great solution to my problem. And it really did sort of surprise me that if I took a couple weeks off work, I was getting kind of sick. I was withdrawing, and I didn't put two and two together, which is that I hadn't been out of the hospital for more than a couple days. So I never really had an opportunity to withdraw before. So in retrospect, it's an aha moment in terms of, like, wow, my addiction was really getting out of control. Mm-hmm. So I had an aha moment at the time, a bad one, that this is a great way to procure drugs illegally without anybody knowing about it. And an aha moment much later when I realized, wow, that was really messed up what I did.
Yeah, wow. Now, your book is titled Free Refills, and you took advantage of your prescription writing abilities. In fact, that's what led you to being exposed when you were writing prescriptions for your nanny, who no longer lived in the United States, but rather was Australia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But it went beyond that, actually, to theft, because you would attend parties and pay secret visits to the host's bathroom searching for medicine chests for drugs. Tell us about that.
Well, I feel really bad about it, and I feel really guilty. But, you know, at the time, again, with my crazy addictive thinking, when you're addicted, the addiction slowly takes over more and more of your brain. And at some point, it starts to really impact the part of your brain that, like, makes good decisions and can decide what's right and what's wrong. So at the time, it seemed like a really good idea. But in retrospect, it's awful. It was very selfish and kind of dangerous and just kind of a crazy thing to do. But at the time, you know, my addiction was progressing, and it was at the point not only where I needed opiates to, like, solve all my emotional problems, but also I was feeling really sick when I wasn't taking them. So I had a lot of impetus to and a lot of pressure to find new sources to feed my habit. And, you know, beggars can't be choosers. So this, at the time, seemed like a very obvious route to obtaining opiates.
I don't know if it was in your book or if I read this somewhere else, but it's But it gave a little hint that told people if you were having a party or having people over to put marbles in your medicine chest. So if someone opened it up, they all fell out.
Oh, yeah. That's actually what people do now. It's interesting. I heard that people do that. Because it's so sad. Trust me, I'm not the only one who did that. And with this current prescription opiate epidemic and the heroin epidemic, I'm sure it's going on a lot. I mean, it's sad that people have to do that, but I did hear that a lot of people are starting to do that.
Yeah, crazy, crazy stuff, but a little tip, I guess. Now, you would also conduct in-home and in-office medication reviews with people, kind of like the brown bag medication reviews where they show you all of their medications and you weed out the unnecessary ones. And then that was just another source for you that you were able to keep some for yourself.
Well, again, at the time, that seemed like a really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed like, a little bit for me, a little bit for them. And again, I was not thinking clearly. I was just addicted, and anything to support my addiction. I mean, there are a lot of things that I didn't do, but I certainly did a lot of things that I feel very guilty and ashamed about. But again, it's just the access to medication combined with the stress. And in my case, once you're addicted, you just have such access to these medications.
Mm-hmm.
And again, as you start losing your ability to know what's right and what's wrong, and that I'll become subjugated to the more pressing need to not feel sick and to obtain medications, you just start doing the craziest things. I think I mentioned in my book that like the craziest things I did were not like when I was on drugs. When I was on drugs, I usually just sat there, mellowed out, and spaced out or slept. The craziest things I did was when I was procuring drugs because, you know, I was desperate.
Right. Right. That's a big word, desperate. Well, let's revisit the day the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, came to your office. As I was reading that, I just thought, wow, I felt for you. That must have been one of the most worst days of your life.
Yeah, no, that was, if not the worst day of my life, one of the worst.
Yeah.
It was just incredibly stressful. I mean, at first it was just surreal. I mean, it's like the last thing you expect, like in your busy day of, I mean, as a primary care doctor, you basically face one obstacle after another, which is why it's sort of stressful to be a primary care doctor. But this was not the kind of obstacle I was expecting to encounter. And, you know, I started trying to talk my way out of it, which has sort of been my modus operandi for the last 49 years. And then the DEA agent cut me off and said, Doc, cut the crap. We know you've been writing bad scripts.
Mm.
And they really, you know, kind of pressured me and got me to divulge all this stuff, which in retrospect, I'm not sad that I divulged because the only way to overcome an addiction is to be completely open and honest. Mm. But at the same time, I did get in a lot of trouble. And, yeah, it was like one of the most stressful things I've ever experienced.
Especially with your staff around, you know, you're trying to keep that from them and maintain.
And my patients, yeah, well, they're all in the waiting room. My patients waiting for me.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a rough moment, and I felt for you. And then you had 3 months in rehab and weekly drug test visits, and that didn't always go so well.
Well, the 3 months in rehab was a kind of mixed experience. I think it really helped me, and I made some really good friends. And I think I really did need to be away from my life. They say, like, when you're in the midst of addiction, you have to change person, places, and things to kind of hit the reset button. You know, rehab is another complicated subject because a lot of the rehab treatments aren't evidence-based, and a lot of them are very old-fashioned, and a lot of kind of not-so-trained people work at rehab. So rehab is sort of a complicated issue. Like, I think it helped me, but it's not necessarily the solution for everybody. I mean, there's not great data that inpatient treatment is better than outpatient treatment. And again, that's sort of a longer conversation. But yet, the drug testing didn't go well because I had a couple slips, and they caught it. Physician Health Services, the group that was monitoring me, and that's part of why physicians do well, because they have this group that tests you, monitors you. It goes right to the board if you flunk a drug test. They encourage you to go to support group meetings with your peers. I mean, it's a great group. And I had a couple slips, and that was really stressful.
And that takes me right to the first passage that I want to read from your book. You say, I came from the heights of Harvard Medical, and they came from the darkest depths of the coal pits, but we were brought to the same place by the same drug. My punishment for being addicted to drugs and for writing phony prescriptions was to reside temporarily in their permanent reality. Yet you speak of the dichotomy in the fact that you felt as a physician the treatment you received was of much higher quality than what most all of other addicts have access to. Let's talk about that.
Well, it's not fair that physicians get sort of better treatment. But I think the case is that physicians do get better treatment for several reasons. One, we just have a lot to fight for. I mean, I would never have had a chance to be a doctor again if I didn't get my act together. And, you know, this is like 10 years of training and hundreds of thousands of dollars in tuition. And this is like my life goal to be a primary care doctor. I would have absolutely lost that completely. We have more resources to throw at our addictions. I mean, most people can't afford rehab. That's a real luxury. And then the third thing is what I think is really important is what I mentioned before, which is we have physician health programs, such as in Massachusetts, I had the physician health services. And they, not only do they drug test, but they monitor you and kind of keep on your case for 5 years. And it's really the aftercare that helps because, you know, the addicts that I see in my inner city primary care clinic in Boston, you know, some of them get detoxed for 3 days and then they're back out in the street.
Mm.
Think of that compared to 90 days of rehab and then 5 years of follow-up.
Right.
I mean, obviously the person with 5 years of follow-up is going to do a lot better.
Yep. Wow. Now, I found it very interesting on my part that most everything I underlined had to do with the physician and perhaps the inherent tendencies. And you mentioned that before about stress and access. And I want to read a couple short one-liners that you wrote that I underlined. You say that by becoming a doctor, you can improve the health of thousands, but it's not necessarily good for your own health. Doctors are mostly expected to continue working no matter how they're feeling, which is part of the problem. A hidden truth is that doctors crack under pressure like anyone else and might even be more susceptible to depression and addiction. Doctors have very unique risks and susceptibilities to addiction. They have the access and the stress. You talk about when doctors were wealthy and important, not minions of the insurance and pharmaceutical companies. And then you go on to say the stresses of medical school were synergistic. Academic pressure, poor nutrition, lack of sleep and exercise, a lack of perspective, the constant pressure of being evaluated. Some of the mentoring doctors threw tantrums, yelled, and humiliated medical students. So I guess we're saying, and you are saying, is that physicians are often doomed to resort to drugs as a quick fix.
Well, I don't know about doomed, but I would say a vulnerable.
Good word.
Susceptible. Again, the stress and the access is amazing, and right now we're in the midst of sort of another epidemic of physician burnout. I mean, very few physicians these days, if you ask them, are pleased with their career choice or would recommend it to their kids or say they would become a doctor if they had to do it all over again. I mean, it is a whole other conversation to discuss all the things that are stressing out physicians between the insurance companies, the tests we have to take, the electronic medical records, the piranhas, attorneys always circling around us, ready to sue, and, you know, just trying to do too many things at once and not having enough time to really connect with our patients. I mean, it's really stressful being a doctor these days. And again, we just have this access. And the final thing is, as I mentioned and as you read, it is part of our culture. Hopefully this is going to change, and I hope with free refills it'll change a little bit more quickly. But we really are not supposed to whine, not supposed to complain, not supposed to miss days at work, because so many people rely upon us. And it's sort of part of our culture that we're like this superhuman machine that always makes it to work and is always there to shoulder everyone else's burdens. And I think that's very unhealthy.
It is. I mean, this is obviously a problem for physicians, and I read somewhere in something that you sent that the Journal of Addiction Medicine revealed that 69% of doctors abused prescription medications. And you also say in your book, in order to address the problem of addicted physicians, it's critical to understand and address what is causing the current epidemic of burnout, and we must destigmatize addiction and offer earlier, non-punitive avenues for the individual to receive help without fear. Do you have any suggestions as to a solution?
Well, I think that would really help patient safety because right now, if a physician is feeling like they're slipping and having trouble, they sort of would be crazy to go to the board and say, hey, I'm having a hard time.
Right.
Because they could lose their license. And I think that if there were non-punitive ways to do this, a lot of people would get help earlier, and that would make them safer doctors, and this would do a lot for patient safety. As it is now, we often only see and learn about the addicted physician. And again, I worked with addicted physicians for several years at Physician Health Services. We only see them when they're melting down, you know, the surgeon drunk in the OR or the person, like, getting busted for a prescription violation like I did. So I think, like with any disease, especially with addiction, the earlier you intervene, the better. And we're just not going to be successful intervening early if the treatment is so punitive. As to how they make the treatment less punitive, that's very complicated. But I think part of it has to do with medical boards who should know better. They're made up of physicians and other people, but a lot of physicians, they should focus more on addiction being a disease and less on it being some kind of character flaw that needs to be punished.
Yeah.
This is a conversation that's happening across our society, and you'd think that physicians would be the leaders, the vanguard of this change in understanding of addiction. And I think if the medical boards and the other institutions that are responsible for regulating physicians became a little bit more kind of enlightened about this, people would get help a lot earlier.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I want to take a little break here to remind folks, if you're just tuning in, you are listening to Speak Up and Stay Alive, Patient Safety Radio, and I am your hostess, Pat Rulo. Today, we are talking to Dr. Peter Grinspoon, a Harvard-trained physician, about his inspiring memoir titled Free Refills, about confronting his opiate addiction and the prevalence of addiction in the medical community. So, let's continue. You did mention that addiction is a brain disease. I mean, is it a disease like cancer, or is it something that people are searching for or missing that impels them to turn to drugs?
Well, yes, both. I think that it is a disease like cancer, and it's sort of amazing that if someone gets cancer, we treat them and feel sorry for them, but if someone has this addiction that's causing an equal amount of pain and suffering, we sort of scorn them.
Yes.
So again, that's starting to change, but it's very complicated how much like of addiction is under your voluntary control. Like a teenager at a party who decides at a party to try a couple pills, that's obviously a conscious choice that they're responsible for. But then 2 years later, when they're completely addicted to heroin, it's not under their control. So it is really difficult to understand how to know how much responsibility, and again, this is a very philosophical discussion, but how much responsibility addicts have for their behaviors.
I was thinking part of a solution, I don't know if this would work, would be something like a buddy system where, you're almost assigned somebody else. And then in your book, you wrote that in a survey published in JAMA in July 2010, 17% of physicians reported having had direct personal knowledge of an impaired or incompetent physician in the hospital group or practice. And of those, one-third didn't report the individuals. Those who kept silent said they believed someone else was taking care of the problem. They feared retribution, or they worried that the physician would be severely punished. Would you yourself, what would you do today if you came upon a physician whom you felt was impaired or otherwise not competent?
Well, first of all, I'm a mandated reporter, so I have to report.
Oh, okay.
As do all these other physicians. Mm-hmm. That's why it's like particularly interesting that a third of them didn't.
Mm-hmm.
I would not necessarily report them immediately to the board. If I thought patients were immediately, imminently at risk, like the example of I saw the surgeon like weaving in the hallway on the way to the OR, then I would report them immediately. I mean, immediate risk to patients, I would report. But generally speaking, I think I would confront them, probably do some kind of intervention, encourage them to sign up with the physician health program so they could get help as soon as possible. And sometimes if they go early and voluntarily to the physician health programs, they can avoid a lot of trouble with the board. People are still afraid to get help, but I would do my best to engage that person and kind of coerce, cajole, and encourage them into treatment as soon as possible. If they completely ignored me, I was convinced that they were impaired, and I was having absolutely no success in getting them to accept the fact they need help and to get them to participate in help, then I probably would have to report them.
Yeah, it seems like if there was a way for peers to reach out to each other to maybe be that internal support system, that could be helpful.
Right, but once you're addicted, there's so much denial. I mean, the last thing I wanted to think was that I had an addiction.
That's true.
That there was something wrong with me and that I had this major problem that was going to disrupt my life. I mean, it's really, and there's a lot of guilt and a lot of shame. So it's a lot easier said than done, like, mm-hmm. to kind of accept help for this kind of problem.
Wow, this is obviously a big nut to crack, isn't it?
Huge. It's complicated.
Mm-hmm. There's so many facets to it. Well, I'm going to ask you a multiple choice question. Hey, didn't know we were in school today. Why is this country in the middle of an opiate crisis? I'm going to give you four choices. A, are doctors overprescribing? B, are patients demanding these drugs? C, are patient satisfaction surveys contributing to physicians doing what it takes to make happy patients so that their survey scores are high, being that there's now a financial incentive to achieve these high scores? Or D, all of the above and more?
I would say A and B. I would say doctors are overprescribing. Patients, a lot of patients are asking for it. I don't think doctors are, I mean, we're worried about our kind of approval ratings, but not to the point where we prescribe opiates to someone.
Okay.
But there are a couple other components. I think the big pharmaceutical companies, such as Purdue Pharmaceuticals, has huge responsibility for the opiate crisis because in the 1990s, they started advertising very heavily to doctors, patients, and pain awareness advocacy groups about how opiates are safe, they're a perfect panacea for long-term treatment for pain, how the overdose risk is really negligible, and they even got in trouble for false advertising. But they were very successful in advertising it. So A, the pharmaceutical companies are really complicit. and culpable. B, doctors sort of went along with it. I think this was kind of a, I mean, there are a few bad apple doctors in the pill mills that hopefully get busted and go away forever. But generally speaking, most doctors are overprescribing. But it's a case of the path to hell is paved with good intentions, because no one's intending to get their patients addicted and have them overdose. They're just trying to treat their pain. It's really important that we look into alternatives to opiates and start to transition these patients off the opiates.
Talk about that in a second. The reason why I asked about the patient satisfaction survey questions, because one of the questions specifically asks the patients about pain, and they have to rate, oh, what was your pain level? So that's why I concluded that in that multiple choice answer.
I don't think physicians are that sensitive to the ratings.
Okay. So you mentioned...
I hope as well. I hope they're not that sensitive.
You mentioned there's other less offensive alternatives. What would those be?
Well, we want to maximize everything that we have. I mean, you know, non-steroidals, even though they're dangerous too, Tylenol, ice, you know, meditation, relaxation, acupuncture, physical therapy. There are really a lot of people go to opiates too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Opiates should be like a last resort. They shouldn't be like, the problem is they become like the standby treatment instead of the last resort. And to say something a little bit controversial, I mean, I personally think the cannabis is vastly safer than the opiates, and it is absolutely crazy that we're not using cannabis for a lot of these chronic long-term pain patients instead of opiates. It's so much safer, and it would get a lot of these people off the opiates. And I think this is where society's moving to. I think this is part of why the societies, a lot of states are legalizing it.
And for folks that maybe you're totally not aware, cannabis is the name for marijuana.
Yeah.
So you mentioned it previously, the legalization of marijuana. You don't see that as a gateway drug that could lead to more illicit drug use. You see it rather as a solution to the opiate crisis.
Absolutely. And there have been some preliminary studies that in states such as Colorado where the cannabis has been legalized or marijuana has been legalized, there's been a drop of overdose deaths. Now, this is preliminary data, but it's pretty interesting. And it sort of makes sense. I mean, it just is so much safer. Nobody can argue, even the people. There's been so much propaganda over the decades against cannabis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been so, like, sort of badmouthed by everybody. But even the staunchest anti-cannabis fanatic can't argue that cannabis is as dangerous as opiates. And, in fact, a lot of people think it's pretty safe and it's really effective for some types of pain. I think that's a field that's going to be exploding over the next 10 years.
Very interesting. I'm glad we got to talk about that. Now, you're back practicing medicine now, and you have the ability to write prescriptions. I was wondering, did you ever consider not getting back into medicine for fear that you might be tempted again and relapse?
Well, I had my thoughts about that. I had my thoughts about not getting back into medicine, A, because of that, B, because of all the bureaucratic hurdles I had to get back to medicine. As you know from reading Free Refills, at some point, it sort of looked like I was on the verge of defeat here. And then C, being a primary care doctor is a very intense job, and there's just a lot of burnout among primary care doctors. Something like 1 out of 6 primary care doctors leaves primary care midway through their career because it's so stressful. So the third thing was that I was a little bit worried about just the stress of being a primary care doctor. But, you know, when all was said and done, I really enjoy being a primary care doctor, and that's what I decided to go back to doing. I've been back at work for 8 years, and it's just been going great.
Now, you wrote, doctors in recovery tend to be outstanding doctors who are humble, who listen, and who empathize. Our struggles and our recovery strengthen precisely the qualities that most people seek in a caregiver, compassion, and a fine-tuned perception of human vulnerability. Has this affected your relationship with patients or potential patients? Do you think that a new patient, knowing your background, would be more likely or less likely to become your patient?
Well, I think because of the stigma, all things being equal, if a patient knew about my background, they'd be less likely to be my patient. But I feel like I'm pretty popular with patients, and I feel like I do a much better job than I did 10 years ago before all this happened.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm a much better listener, much more down-to-earth, and a much more sort of compassionate person. A lot of the tools you learn in recovery, for example, things like, you know, not obsessing about things that you can't control and, like, trying to live in the present as opposed to the past and the future, help other aspects of your life, not just staying off drugs, and they really help taking care of patients. So I personally think that I do a much better job using the recovery skills that I have.
I would think so. I tried to put myself as the patient and try to answer that question, and I would have no problem with it, thinking exactly what you said, that this person's already been through all of this and came out the other end probably a much more compassionate and understanding doctor and human being.
But if the patient does have a problem with it, that's totally fine too. It's up to them.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Now, do you think there'll come a time when you don't want to talk about this anymore, or has this experience really become your life's mission?
Well, I don't know if it's become my life's mission, but I'm really concerned about the opiate epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really concerned about the overdoses. And I feel like I just feel like this has given me a perspective on opiate use and opiate addiction. I mean, I've been a treater. I've worked with physicians, and I treat a lot of patients in my clinic, and I've been a patient and someone who's suffered. So I feel like very eager to use my experience to help people and to help kind of move the debate along away from stigma towards compassion and understanding.
Absolutely, and I'm so proud of you and for you for the work that you're doing. What words of advice would you give to a fellow physician who might find him or herself tempted by this inherent opportunity?
Get help early. Really, go to a psychiatrist, go to an addiction specialist, go to a support group meeting. You can talk to the physician health programs. Don't adopt the role of like the Superman who can take care of all your problems for yourself. I mean, the two main keys are, one, admitting that you have a problem, and two, asking for help. And those are so much easier said than done. But if you could do those two things, you're going to be just fine.
Well, with that, I would imagine the family is an important catalyst towards regaining health. How can a family member or a friend help someone who may not be willing to admit that they have a problem?
Well, it's very difficult if someone's, you know, really not going to admit that they have a problem and can't see that they have a problem. You know, it puts family members and friends in really difficult situations. It puts colleagues in really difficult situations, too. You know, you talk to them, you encourage them, you act compassionately. Sometimes you need to coerce them. If they're self-destructing, you can do an intervention. I mean, it's very controversial, like the ethics of coercing people into treatment for substance abuse. There are really, really strong arguments on either side. Personally, I don't think I ever would have gotten better if I didn't get clubbed over the head with, like, the board, the criminal charges, the state police, the DEA, the loss of the medical license. I think I needed all that.
Mm-hmm.
But other people don't. And, you know, you just have to figure out what works. And there's no, you know, one size fits all, particularly in addiction. I mean, I always think a good resource is to just consult with an addiction specialist and just tell the person, we're just going to consult and see what they have to say.
Now, if a doctor consults with a addiction specialist, does that become public record? Can he or she do that privately? And not?
Well, that's really complicated. It's private. Doctors are patients, too. Our medical records are protected, especially mental health visits are absolutely completely protected. However, again, the addiction specialist, as a physician, he or she will be a mandated reporter. So if you go to an addiction specialist expecting confidentiality and say, oh, yeah, I drink 2 bottles of vodka before I operate on patients, obviously the addiction specialist is going to have to report you. They have an obligation. They will get in trouble, and it's unethical not to. So you do have privacy, but there is this mandated reporting thing, which also intimidates people into silence and into not getting help. But that's a very complicated thing because you sort of need it as well, because you have to report someone who's like in imminent danger.
Right.
So it puts everybody in a really difficult situation.
Yeah. Wow. It's hard to seek help without risking your livelihood.
Right. So who would get help? If you don't, you have a problem, why would you get help? But again, the earlier you help people, the better. This is a disease like any other disease. If you could intervene early, you can avoid, like if somehow I were able to have intervention 5 years before the state police came to my office. There's so much like dislocation and trouble and expense and pain and suffering, not just for me, but for my family, friends, patients, colleagues. So much of that would have been avoided.
Wow, what a journey, what a journey. Now, I know there's just so much, but is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to bring up today?
Well, I just want to say that opiate addiction, which is, again, dominating the news, pretty amazing that it's like the one thing the Republicans and the Democrats agree on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody can come up with another issue that they all agree on. It's such a big problem with the overdoses and the widespread abuse. But I just want to say that opiate addiction doesn't have to be a death sentence. And I just want to encourage people, if they have friends or loved ones who are struggling with opiates, just don't give up on them. They're still there underneath it. No matter how annoying or alienating their behavior might be, they're still there underneath. I can tell you that from having been through it. And you can't give up on them. You just have to treat them with compassion and do everything you can to get them into treatment. You might not succeed, but you just keep trying.
Right. Well, now, where can folks go to get a copy of your book, and how can they contact you?
Well, my website, petergrinspoon.com, has a very easy-to-use mechanism for contacting me, and I get back to people right away. And it's easy to buy my book. It's in most bookstores, and it's also on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all the other places that they sell books online.
Great. PeterGrinspoon.com. I also have this on our website as well. All right. Well, in wrapping up, I would like to just read how you ended your book, if I may. You write, "Being an addicted physician, I had the potential to harm many more people than most addicts, though airline pilots and nurses can do a pretty good job. I was the wolf in sheep's clothing. I was deceiving people left and right who trusted me to help them to do no harm and who trusted the establishment I represented. I had the trust and I had power. I had the trust of my patients, the DEA, the medical board, and my colleagues. Everyone gives the doctor the benefit of the doubt. People in other circumstances might have noticed some missing pills, but it never would have occurred to them that their doctor was skimming them off the top. Once I violated my doctorly trust, all hell broke loose. I damaged myself and my profession. As a physician, the treatment I received was of much higher quality than what most other addicts have access to. Most addicts don't have a society to help physicians to force them to abstain. They can't afford rehab and don't have anything as tangible as a medical license to fight for. I look at the help I received compared to the substandard care I was exposed to and can only marvel at those who have brought themselves into recovery without my advantages. However, my addiction should never have progressed to the point that the state police and the DEA came to my office. This represents a failure, though it's difficult to pinpoint exactly where the failure occurred. If we aren't adequately and compassionately caring for our caregivers and helping our doctors who are in trouble and teaching them how to avoid trouble in the first place, then something very fundamental is wrong with our entire system. And I just want to say that your candor and your willingness to share your story by writing this book, Free Refills, and by speaking to your fellow physicians is a mighty big step towards solving the problem. And you have won my heart. I'm absolutely thrilled to have met you, and I thank you so much for allowing this conversation.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for reading the book and for having me on your show.
It's my pleasure. Dr. Peter Grinspoon, folks, I encourage you to read his book, Free Refills. You can get it at petergrinspoon.com.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.
Hi there, I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, the host of Mrs. Green's World, and I would really love for you to become a part of that world. We talk about things like the faceless villain of climate change, our compromised food supply, and about how to become a conscious consumer. But it's not all bad news. We educate, we inspire, we engage. We always leave you with some small steps you can take to make a difference for this great planet of ours and help you live the healthy life you deserve. Please visit MrsGreensWorld.com to learn more and become a part of our world.
Time always goes by so quickly when we're together. But the good news is, I'll be back next week. Same time, same place, but never the same information. Until we meet again, I hope you have a healthy and a happy week. I am Pat Rulo, and I am your guide to safe and successful healthcare and hospital encounters.
Listen to Pat Rulo and Speak Up and Stay Alive Radio. Stay safe from little-known healthcare and hospital hazards. To learn more, go to speakupandstayalive.com. That's speakupandstayalive.com.